When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Howdy folks, Craig here. In this episode, Matthew Peterson reveals why Neverborn players are so excited about Dreamer in Malifaux 3rd Edition. You'll have no trouble staying awake when you hear all his secrets, including the upgrades he always takes and the first model he hires into every Dreamer crew. You non-Dreamer players out there are going to want to pay close attention, or Dreamer will be spanking you with a cricket bat in your next matchup. Before we jump in, we have a special offer from our friends at Gadzooks Gaming. Now, Gadzooks has always been one of my favorite online retailers because of their unique selection and great customer service. They're probably best known for selling individual Malifaux models, so you don't have to buy an entire crew box for just that one model you need. Check them out as you start building your crews for 3rd edition. They're offering our U.S. and Canadian listeners a sweet deal, free shipping on all orders over $100. Use the promo code THIRDFLOOR, one word, THIRD, and using that promo code helps us bring you content on this podcast and our YouTube channel. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and use the promo code THIRDFLOOR. All the details are in the show notes. Now on to the episode. There's masters in this game in three that you can't let them do what they want to do for that long.
And now the nastiest part about this particular attack action is the trigger on a mask, which you will be using stones for, I promise you.
With all the masks that Dreamer needs and how card hungry he sounds like he can be, that you're under a lot of pressure when you're playing him. Can we talk a little bit about the Lucid Dreams and the deck manipulation? All right, so the next big question is that they're six soul stones, right?
Yes.
Would you hire them at seven? Be honest.
There are few things better than stepping away from the screens. Unplugging and sitting around a table to do battle with your friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars brings you the latest strategies, tactics, and reviews on board games, card games, and miniature games like Malifaux. If you want useful information on the games you already play, or new insights on great games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're going to do a deep dive into the Neverborn Master Dreamer and how the Nightmare Crew works in Malifaux 3rd Edition. My guest is Matt Peterson. You're likely familiar with his contributions to the forums and A Weird Place. He's very active in the growing Pacific Northwest meta. With multiple games with Dreamer and the Nightmare Crew under his belt, he has generously agreed to let me pick his brain. So, Matt, welcome to the Third Floor.
Hey, Craig. Thanks for having me.
So, obviously, we're going to talk about Dreamer, but I would like to first kind of get a sense of how you found Malifaux.
Absolutely. I am one of the many guests that you've had on the show talk about their origins in gaming in Warhammer Fantasy Battles. So, my brother and I started early, young, pushing around block troops on the table. Got into the tournament scene pretty heavy with Warhammer Fantasy. I mean, it was a really huge game up here in the Northwest. We had large tournaments that brought people from all over the country and even folks from England, you know. So when that game imploded, I was left in the dust to kind of find something else to do. Wanted to give AOS a shot, but unfortunately, that game just never seemed to pan out for me. So with that, I was kind of on a quest to find something new. My brother had mentioned hey, why don't you check out Malifaux? You know, something that he'd been into and played in tournaments. And, you know, I'd always eyed it from a distance, but never something I'd gone to their website or looked at the models really in depth or the rules. And, you know, I was hooked. You know, once I went to the, it was the fourth wave. So Zip was just released, Titania, those models. Oh, nice. So, yeah, so sort of late second edition is when I got into the game.
So, all right. So you're like literally like the, I don't know, 30th person I've talked to, even offline or on the podcast, that went from fantasy to Malifaux. And I really like, I kind of know the answer to this, but I'd like to hear your perspective. What do you, why do you think that is? Why do you think that Malifaux found so many fantasy players? And we know why they left fantasy, right? But why do you think it was Malifaux that so many of them found a home?
Well, something that happened late in Warhammer Fantasy Battle was the Swedish comp system, which added another layer of complexity to building your army list. It sort of graded the OP elements that everyone saw and made them factor higher in your Swedish comp score. So we sort of had this balancing act of not only building armies based off your point values, what works in the game, what doesn't work, but you have to weigh it against a comp system that was nuanced, that changed, and that really challenged all of us players to come up with stuff that was fair to against the field and really execute our tactical ability to, you know, complete missions on the field and use armies that weren't completely OP and broken.
I think that's very cool. And you know, towards the end of 2E, there was talk of, you know, putting comp in place for Malifaux. And so I can see where that complexity added an extra layer, but I guess I'm trying to understand, Matt, like, how does that translate to Malifaux? I get a sense that fantasy play, a certain segment of fantasy players, a lot of them went to AOS and love it there. And I've heard that AOS is a really good game. So don't misinterpret this as a bash of that game. Though I do wish that GW in general made rules as good as they made models. but I guess I'm trying to figure out, you know, it was there something that you found in fantasy, especially with that Swedish comp system, maybe, that made you feel at home in Malifaux? Or is there something about Malifaux that you didn't have in fantasy and it made you happy? Like, I'm trying to understand the transition of why Malifaux stuck for so many fantasy players.
Absolutely. And again, that was kind of a tangent into Swedish comp, but it does segue into why Malifaux works for us. And I believe it has to do with the layers of decision-making. That doesn't require going online or looking at tournament results and seeing what the field is using and winning with, and merely copying that and kind of adopting that mentality into your own play style. The Swedish comp allowed people to really find their own personality within Warhammer Fantasy Battle, which is what Malifaux essentially does with the myriad of models that you can choose from, masters, tactical approaches. I mean, the game is just chocked full of variety, but it's all balanced in a sense that the volume of decisions the players have to make is the key importance in the game, not necessarily the power of each individual model.
I see what you're saying. So, like, unlike 40K, where the latest net list is what everybody brings to the next event, you're saying that because of that comp system, it really allowed players to have a little bit more agency in the process and really kind of find their own thing and compete based off of the quality of their play versus what models they brought to the table.
Yeah. And in a way it also tackled power creep too, because in that world, it's all about the newest, latest models. And they typically are better models than what has been previously released. So with that, you know, Swedish comp allowed you to look deeper into, you know, some of the more basic models that had effectiveness in the field of play if you use them correctly. And that translates directly to Malifaux. And when you're hiring a bunch of 5-stone minions, because the pool says, bring a bunch of 5-stone minions and challenge your opponent to chase you because they're looking to kill you. And the pool says you can score more schemes or whatever the situation may be. It really allows you to focus on all of the tools available and how to utilize them.
Yeah. And I think you touched on what I think is, probably the secret weapon, which isn't a secret about Malifaux, and that is the way that they structure the win conditions, the way that the pools work. And, you know, you're starting to see some games fool around with it a little bit. Even GW is starting to fool around with that idea a little bit. But I'm amazed that more games have not just straight up copy and pasted and lifted the idea. Because if someone, you know, pinned me to a corner and said, what is the one thing that makes Malifaux Malifaux and makes you love it so much? I have to start with the pools.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the whole poker bluff, playing your opponent and their body language, intentions, what you perceive their intentions to be, and then vice versa. You know, which cup has the poison in it? You're constantly playing that with your opponent, regardless of what models they brought. Obviously, the knowledge of those models will help in your decision making, but ultimately, you know, what's your opponent telling you through their actions and their decisions?
Yeah, yeah, it's so good. It's so good.
So good.
But everybody's really surprised you and I are fanboys, right?
Right.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about Dreamer and the Nightmare Crew. So what I plan to do, Matt, is really kind of dig deep into kind of how do you build a Nightmare Crew? I want to get a sense of, you know, how the crew plays, how Dreamer plays, ultimately get a sense of, you know, how you use a Nightmare Crew to win matches. And, you know, we're going to talk about how that relates to the scheme pools, the strategy pools, and we'll even talk about, you know, how to counter some of that power. So let's give the listeners a quick overview of Dreamer, and let's imagine that someone listening right now, Matt, has never seen Dreamer on the table. They've never played Dreamer, never read his cards, and you know, what is Dreamer?
Absolutely. This is exciting for me because Dreamer was the master that I clicked on the webpage and thought, hey, I got to get into this game. I mean, his fluff and where he comes from, his story is just, it's just excellent. It's original. And it inspired me to go out and buy models. So with that, you know, he is the quintessential summoner for the Neverborn faction. With that, with the summoning elements, he also is a support master. He's going to help his models be more effective in killing enemy models. That is what the crew is designed to do as a whole. He has a little bit of damage elements on his card. He's able to reach out and do a bit of damage, notably his Twist Reality attack action, which is a ranged gun action. It ignores armor and incorporeal with a 2-3-4 damage track.
Ooh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. So with that, his summoning is really central to what he's doing. His main mechanic or his main keyword ability on most of his models is going to be Feed on Fear. All right. And this says after an enemy model within the model's engagement range fails willpower duels, they heal 1 damage.
Oh, okay.
So basically, anytime you have one of your nightmares out there engaging an enemy model and you're ticking away at them with willpower attacks or their own terrifying checks against some of those models, uh-huh, any failure means they're healing a point of damage.
That kind of has a feel of like M2E Sheamus a little bit, where you're capitalizing off of failed willpower duels. That's very neat.
Absolutely. And that kind of leads into how Dreamer's summoning mechanic works. You know, in this game, all summoners pretty much have summoning upgrades that attach to their models when they're summoned. So Dreamer's is special in that when he does summon a model, they come in stunned and they come in buried.
Oh, okay.
So kind of funky. It feels like Terra in a way. She gets them out with a different mechanic. What Dreamer has to do to get these models on the field is have enemies fail willpower duels, either through friendly actions or abilities.
But it doesn't cease to amaze me how thematic that these guys were able to make three. Summoning was a problem in two. And I think everybody realized that. And obviously the designers did as well. And not only did those guys, I think, do a good job of making summoning still part of the game, but controlling it. But like every time I'm doing one of these deep dives or I'm talking to somebody, like every one of the factions has some sort of summoning and it's all very different. But what you just said completely fits with how Dreamer works. And before we move on, Matt, So I want to learn a lot more about how that summoning works, because it's very unique. Can you explain to everybody exactly, kind of thematically, what Dreamer is? I mean, we know the model's a little boy, but I think there might be people that don't really understand just how cool Dreamer is.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. We should probably have delved a little bit more into his fluff. But Dreamer is a young human boy on Earthside who, when he sleeps, his dreams take place in Malifaux. He literally exists in Malifaux and can affect the people in Malifaux with his imagination and or his special abilities that a certain tyrant took notice of by the name of Lord Chompy Bits. That's what Dreamer named him. His real name is Nightmare. And he's the titan or tyrant, excuse me, that basically is the embodiment of nightmares for all people on Earthside, you know. And he stalks Malifaux and has Dreamer by his side and is kind of cultivating this young boy's power and his ability to affect the war and the ever going battle that's happening in Malifaux.
Yeah, it's so cool. And when I had already kind of left GW, was playing a lot of Guild Ball, and always was kind of a Weird West fan. Always liked the idea of Weird West. I played some RPG set in Weird West. So I was kind of poking around on the internet, you know, looking at Weird West miniatures and wondering if there's kind of a game. And I came across two games. I came across Malifaux and I came across Wild West Exodus. And Wild West Exodus was relatively new at the time. And thematically, for what I was kind of looking for, which was a skirmish game that kind of had that Weird West feel to it, they both kind of fit it. So I was clicking around on the Wild West Exodus stuff and thought kind of their alt history was kind of neat, and the fact that you could be Abe Lincoln in the game and stuff like that. But then I got to Malifaux and was poking around, and of course started with Guild, and it was, you know, like Perdita and stuff like that that had the Western theme. And then I found Dreamer. And it's so funny, even though I didn't end up playing Neverborn, it's same thing happened to me, Matt. It was Dreamer that made me go, okay, I don't know what this is, but this is really cool and I need to learn a lot more about it. And anybody who doubts how cool the Dreamer fluff is and just the concept behind Dreamer, just know the Privateer Press created a whole faction based off of Dreamer when they created the Grimkin, which I think is a little bit of a carbon copy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And what's also cool is kind of his arc. You know, he has grown up, and you do see the way the other side and what's happening in London currently in the story is affecting him. So, yeah. How cool and original of an idea. And then to follow it up with, you know, developing his character over time is just awesome. I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, and it's little details like he calls him Lord Chompy Bits that I was just like, all right, that's cool. That's just cool. And, you know, I'm sure that's been pieced together over time at Weird, but they ended up, I think, tapping into a little bit of gold. So so Dreamer's summoning, and when he's summoning, he's, you know, bringing in a model or two, and they're coming in buried. I think the first thing I want to understand, Matt, is how is he making these willpower duels fail? Is it just terrorizing chats, or how does he get these models onto the table after they're summoned?
Absolutely. Well, Dreamer himself has a few willpower duels that he can reach out and hit people with. And namely, I did mention Twist Reality earlier, and that can be selected to target defense or willpower. That gives you a little versatility there to hit their willpower at a stat 6. And in this game, we all know, you know, willpowers are typically 5 or 6, you know, at most. So a stat 6 willpower check is pretty good. Now, he also has another attack action called Your Nightmare, which is 8-inch range. Again, a stat 6 against willpower. And this gives the model adversary Nightmare.
Ooh.
And built in, any model that's engaging that model gains focus +1.
Okay, that's cool.
And now the nastiest part about this particular attack action is the trigger on a mask, which you will be using stones for, I promise you, called Night Stalker. It says place a friendly Lord Chompy Bits into base contact with the target.
So you don't summon Chompy Bits in the normal way.
No, you do not. He is his totem. So he comes alongside, and we'll get to Lord Chompy Bits. We'll talk about him. We're going to get on Dreamer's card here and just kind of explain what he does. But I do believe that Night Stalker trigger is key to making the Dreamer crew work. So it's something that just has to be set out front. 8-inch range, willpower check, put Chompy in base contact with you from anywhere on the table.
Very nice. Very nice. Give me kind of a sense of Dreamer's defensive capabilities. So what keeps Dreamer alive on the table?
Absolutely. Dreamer has abilities on the front of his card that keep him alive. He has Serene Countenance, negative flips to any attack actions that target him. He has Protected Nightmare. So the versatility there with a 2-inch chuck a card and toss it on to any nightmare within range is really big.
That's good. Karai has that. Marcus has that. Those are good abilities.
Absolutely. They're double-edged, though, honestly. I think that being a deterrent from attacking him shouldn't be. If you do have the focus and can get through the Serene Countenance, making any of those masters chuck cards is a problem. Yep. These are all masters that don't have card draw. So, the player's making a choice to get rid of a card, at that point. So he also has Incorporeal. We all know what that does in terms of mitigating damage. And then he has Diversion, which is interesting on his card. Models within Aura 4 cannot declare bonus actions.
Oh, that's good.
Surprisingly, it comes into play pretty often and is pretty devastating to certain models that kind of rely on that bonus action to kind of tune them up and give them what they need to be effective.
Yeah, a lot of times that bonus action can be what tops off a model. And in a lot of cases, it can be why you brought the model.
Absolutely. In case of riders who like to be aggressive, Dreamer can easily, with Incorporeal, take a couple walk actions and get right within that range and maybe even pop a nightmare in base contact with them. And they're stuck there having to, hack this nightmare off of them and probably not even get their bonus action as a result. So
yeah, they're not gonna be able to push out of that.
Yep. Yeah. So in terms of that, his defensive capabilities, there's one more thing that I would like to note, and that is his attack action. Actually, his claw action is a cricket bat. 1-2-3 damage that does +1 damage per friendly buried nightmare up to maximum of 2.
That's so nice.
He can get a little extra damage out there. I don't think that that's necessarily a straightforward go strategy. But namely, there's another mask trigger on here. He is very mask dependent, but it says enemy only, place this model in base contact with the friendly nightmare within 6 inches, then place the friendly nightmare into base contact with the target. So it's almost a way for him to just get out of jail. Someone's up in his face, punishing him or costing him resources. He can spend a stone for that mask if he needs to, spend a high card and just teleport right up out of there and, walk away if he needs to.
Yeah. And in certain situations, that could be absolutely key. How many wounds does he have?
Dreamer is only bringing 7 wounds to the table.
Yeah, I was going to guess it was going to be low like that, because that's a lot of defensive technology. And, obviously we'll get into, counters and things like that. But I can tell you, as somebody who's played a lot of Molly, one of the things that I think that we're going to, a lot of people will, after they play against my Molly a few times, will go, I don't even bother going at her. And it was the same way with Nelly in Guild back in 2E. And unfortunately, going in on these masters, I think, and you hinted at this, Matt, like it's almost like the defensive tech is more psychological than mechanical. They see the Serene Countenance and they go, oh, what a pain in the butt. They see the fact that you could shrug off to a nightmare that's close, and they go, oh, that's just a pain. I'm just not going to bother with them. So it's almost like, you might want to just go at them.
Yeah, it is really funny, and we'll get into that with counters, but I couldn't agree with you more. It's like any real fight. You don't want to get into it, but you just got to, and you got to go in hard and fast and really just give them all you got. So with that, I totally agree. That is the counter to these super defensive techie masters, because they're chucking cards, and if everything goes right, you're killing a session or you're killing a daydream also. So they're losing a card and they're losing a model, which is definitely putting them behind in terms of how those masters cultivate power.
And the other thing too, I'm finding in three, and I don't know if you feel this as with Dreamer or not, Matt, but I'm finding with three that, you know, when you go against some of these masters that just seem so strong, and what you don't realize is how you don't see the pressures the opponent's under when they're playing them. So like with Molly, you know, there's an activation order pressure that I'm under. And if for me to get the most out of her, I really need to activate my models in a certain order to maximize her abilities. And whether my opponent realizes it or not, when they start screwing with my ability to decide what I'm going to activate next by putting pressure in different places, they really screw it up for me. And I'm getting the sense that with all the masks that Dreamer needs and how card hungry he sounds like he can be, that you're under a lot of pressure when you're playing him.
Oh, absolutely. You need things to go off when you're playing him. You know, yeah, his card has three mass triggers and one ram trigger, and that's it. I mean, his bonus action goes off on a six. So, you know, he is requiring a lot of good moderate cards, at least, you know, above moderate, and good suits. So, you know, most Dreamer players are going to be bringing a lot of stones, which means their crews are probably going to start smaller. And there's an imperative to not only summon the model, but have your opponent fail a willpower check to get that model actually into play and doing anything for you. So,
yeah, and it's kind of tough too, because, you know, in an ideal world, you don't want your game plan to involve decisions that can be made by your opponent. But if your summoning mechanic requires a failure on your opponent's side, you need them not to cheat or not have the cards to cheat in order to make that happen. So that's got to be some pressure there too.
Yeah, you're saving your one high card to not necessarily do damage, but to cause a failed willpower duel to bring a model on the table. Then you're relying on basically top decking most of your attack actions and damage flips to get the most out of your models, which is why he has the ability on a lot of his nightmares to lucid dream, which is a big point and topic on the forums that should be discussed, definitely. But I think in terms of how it affects his crew and what he requires as a resource intense master, he's one of those masters that builds over time. So it puts more impetus on getting in his face and being aggressive early and putting the pressure on before he builds up.
You know, people say the same thing about Yanlo. You know, they really, you know, they start, bitching about, you know, Yanlo in turn four, he's so good. And all of us Yanlo players are like, well, why did you let us get to turn four? That's not on me. That's on you. You know, there's masters in this game in three that you can't let them do what they want to do for that long.
Absolutely. And that's a luxury of third edition. I'm playing this master. So go to your toolbox and consider that when you're building your crew.
Yeah, the whole idea that you revealed masters before building crew, when I first saw that, I was like, what the hell are they thinking? But I got to tell you, man, the more three I'm playing, the more time I'm realizing that it's not just a rock, paper, scissors game. Like, it's required because of how good masters are in three.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, it's one of those layers of decisions put on the players that they have to make. You know, and the one that makes the better counter decision, whether it be just, you know, throwing it into the wind or making a wild guess or whatever, that's who's going to win the game, you know, and sometimes that takes risks, taking risks and going out, you know, going for it with certain models or choices or decisions.
Yeah. And as a player, I'm not there yet, Matt, but I'm starting to get the feeling that, you know, when I would get a tournament pool ahead of time. So we got a tournament this Saturday and we got the pools on Monday, and I've already created about 15 lists for three rounds because that's what I do. And, you know, usually what I would do though for an event is that I would end up saying, these are the crews I'm bringing. And in two, you could kind of do that. You could kind of say, I'm going to, you know, really, you know, spend a lot of time and add some models, remove some models, play around with some upgrades. And, you know, when I hit the table, regardless of what they declare, what the terrain looks like and stuff, I'm running this crew. I had a game last night and I went into it with a crew that I had already decided on because we had the pool ahead of time. And I said, okay, I'm going to run this crew. And the board was really tight lanes, especially in deployment. And I brought a Molly, a McMorning crew with a lot of 50 mil bases in it. And I was screwed. I was stuck in my deployment zone. I couldn't get out of it in time and efficiently enough. And if I, you know, had already started playing at that next level, I would have seen the table and said, yeah, I can't bring this many 50 mils to this game. And that's just a small example of what I think I'm seeing here in three. So Matt, we got a really good question related to summoning from James. So let's hear what James had to say.
Hello, Third Floor Wars. This is James up in Alaska. My question in regards to the Dreamer is the utility of his summoning ability. I've played a couple of games now, and I'm not quite sure where it's going to fit in. It never really did anything for me. Thanks.
Awesome. All the way up in Alaska playing Malifaux. That's great to hear. Well, thanks for the question. And yeah, the summoning aspect can be tough. And again, that kind of comes back to the two-layer summoning approach and the fact that you have to spend perhaps a stone and a pretty decent card to get the model even summoned into the queue. And then you have to maybe have another high card that you're going to force into a willpower check to then get that model on the field, you know, where you want it or wherever you can get it on the field. So, you know, with that, Dreamer summons a Alp on a 9, a Stitch Together on a 10, and an Insidious Madness on an 11. So that pretty much leaves your 12s and 13s available to really put into those willpower checks that you're going to be out there aggressively seeking with models that have ranged willpower checks. And that's really going to ensure that you can get models on the table. Sometimes it's not always where you want it because, again, your opponent could dictate who's even in range of these checks. But in the Neverborn faction, there are quite a few models that have range-based bonus actions that, you know, are 8-inch range, target willpower. So those are models that I look for to hire in any Dreamer crew, depending on who I'm playing against and what the situation is. Because it's just a threat range ability to say, hey, I can walk twice and psh, there's an Insidious Madness in your face because you can't stop a 12 with my 6 or a 13 with my 6.
So here's a question, Matt. So, you know, the summoner in Rezzers is Albus, right? And at first glance, it seems, you know, that it's critical that you get those summons off. And I think even in two, the summoners, if they weren't summoning, they were losing. And I'm noticing that's not necessarily true in three. And Albus, for example, if he goes a whole game without summoning, he can still win that game and be very effective. Do you think that's true of Dreamer? Which I think kind of ties to James's question. Like, does he have to be summoning to be winning?
I absolutely believe that he does. I think you need to build your crews around what I'm speaking about in terms of finding ranged willpower duels and finding willpower attack actions at high values to get those models on the field. Dreamer does not have a lot of action repeats or the ability to trigger, you know, incidental scheme marker drops or anything. Yeah. He has to use his models the old-fashioned way to walk and interact to drop a scheme. You know, just like every, you know, just like the basic rules tell you. So with that, you know, his action economy is summoning minion models onto the field.
Got it.
They're summoned in danger, fighting another model, but hopefully you've put enough pressure on them or they're going to be able to come out on top based on their own physical prowess. You know, these models can all fight. They're all decently defensive. So with that, you're just trying to get these models on the field and killing other models to gain that positioning and disrupt your opponent.
Well, man, I want to learn a lot about, you know, those different summoning options and really about the crew. So let's take a quick break. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to pick Matt's brain. We're going to learn, you know, when do you summon one versus the other? And also, what is the core crew that Matt brings to the table? We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. With 3rd edition Malifaux released, it's time for you to get a new mat with new deployment zones. We've tried every mat in the business, and nobody has better quality and selection than Mats by Mars. They're waterproof and they roll and unroll easily, and they're even wet erase Marco compatible. They offer over 35 designs and let you add M3E overlays for making deployment and positioning a breeze. Check them out at matsbymars.com. They are offering a sweet discount for our listeners. After you found the perfect mat, use the promo code 3rdFloor to get 10% off your entire order. If you really want to support us, in the notes of your order, request that our logo be put in the corner of your mat. It's the only way to make the best mat in the business even cooler. Again, that's Mat by Mars. Use the promo code 3rdFloor to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. So I've got to say, it makes me really happy that Dreamer is as cool mechanically as I've always thought he was. And, you know, if I had all the time in the world, Matt, I would be playing every faction. And I was dead set that I was going to continue with Rezzers into three. And then my second faction in three was going to be Neverborn. And then I started hearing stuff about Explorer Society. So I might have to put the Explorers ahead of that. But I can tell you right now, my first Neverborn master someday will be Dreamer. He sounds really cool. But let's talk about the other models. So the first thing I want to get a sense of, Matt, and we'll get into, you know, summoning and things like that. When do you summon A or B or C? But I'd like to know when you're sitting down, you've got 50 stones and you're building the crew. What are the models that, other than the totem, obviously, that you automatically bring into the crew?
Absolutely. I'm going to come at you with a curveball and say that I start with two upgrades with this crew.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So Dreamer is going to be given an ancient pact pretty much every game. This allows him to avoid Doom, which says if he flips the Black Joker, he can discard the Black Joker without effect and flip a new card in its place.
That's a big deal for a summoner.
Yeah, I mean, you get to do it once per turn. So you can't afford to Black Joker summons with how important it is to get these models on the field. Again, needing a 9 to get an Alp, you know, use that 9. The Alp is great. They'll do the job. Also, on Ancient Pact, it gives you Ill Omens 1. So you get a +1 to your initiative flip, which is nice. I mean, you're going to be giving your opponent pass tokens, typically only one per turn. So you kind of break even on that whole, +1 initiative thing, which gives you a fighting chance in terms of winning initiative. Secondly, I get Inhuman Reflexes, and we put that right on Lord Chompy Bits. I think this is a no-brainer as well. I mean, Lord Chompy Bits is a great model at 8 stones. He's a henchman. He can eat stones to mitigate damage. But with Butterfly Jump attached to his kit, I mean, it just makes him really hard to bring down. And you really need that in this crew to keep things going and to have the punch you need to win.
So out of curiosity, I mean, obviously I can summon Lord Chompy, right? But you can bring him for free, right? Or no?
No summoning Lord Chompy Bits. Dreamer can only summon his 4 minion models.
So I misunderstood it. So that trigger allows you to place Lord Chompy Bits?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, Craig. Yeah. The Your Nightmare trigger is merely a place Lord Chompy Bits in base contact with the target, which is 8 inches from Dreamer. So this allows you to really feint with Lord Chompy Bits.
Got it.
Go off into different regions of the board and maybe score some early points. And just brutalize maybe some scheme runners that might be out there, or just mismatch a certain part of the board, and then just immediately bring him to another part of the board through, you know, one failed willpower check, which might also bring another nightmare into base contact with them as well. So you're basically popping 2 nightmares in contact with a model within 8 inches, one of which being, you know, Lord Chompy Bits, a very serious beater.
Yeah, I mean, and in its own weird way, it's worse than summoning him, because he's doing work for you out of like turn one. And then, you know, he can be off in left field, you know, doing, you know, chomping up a scheme runner or something like that. And with that trigger in your back pocket, and especially with some stones, you can say, you know what, I need you back here. And wow, that's really good, Matt.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, again, like you were talking about the thematic thing, it fits his theme. I mean, Chompy Bits is always watching Dreamer's back and is a tyrant. So he's going to be wherever he needs to be. And you know, as long as the cards are there, it's going to work out for you.
So, and I would assume, let's talk a little bit about Chompy. So, I'm sure he's a beater. So let's talk about what kind of damage output he has.
Absolutely. Chompy, the great thing about him is he is movement six. So that's really great speed for a 50 mil base. He's got 2-inch reach on his attack. So again, just great range in terms of damage. 3-4-6 on his profile. He's got a couple triggers, tear off a bite to heal 2. And he's also got an execute trigger on a
crew. I hate those things so much.
Yeah. And it's nice to have that too, because with Dreamer, you know, sucking up all the masks, you know, it gives you an opportunity to maybe use some of your Rams and Crows through Lord Chompy bits and maybe get a little extra bonus off of those cards. He also comes with Twist Reality at 8-inch range, which is a gun action right on Chompy's card. So, you know, he can hit you up close and he can shoot you from far away as well. And also, you know, bring nightmares out with that attack at 8-inch range.
And you mentioned he's a totem and a henchman, right? So he can use stones?
Yes. Yes, he is a henchman.
Yeah. All right. So other than stones, what's keeping Chompy Bits upright?
Well, he's got a Regeneration 2 ability on the front of his card. And then Tear Off a Bite with his attack action really helps. And he's got the Nightmare front of card keyword ability, Feed on Fear. So he's got a 2-inch range with his claw. So he's, you know, he's pretty much engaged a lot of the times, and models will be failing willpower checks, and he heals that way.
Well, and really, there's kind of a hidden defensive tech in Dreamer, and we hinted at it in the first segment, but I'd like to kind of delve into it now. Can we talk a little bit about the Lucid Dreams and the deck manipulation?
Absolutely. And this is right on Lord Chompy Bits' card as well. So he is able to take the bonus action Lucid Dream, which says to reveal the top 3 cards of this model's fate deck, choose one revealed non-joker and remove it from the game. Then discard the other revealed cards.
And that's permanent for the rest of the game.
That's permanent for the rest of the game. And that is a bonus action that requires no flip whatsoever. It just happens. Oh.
And that's pretty common, you said, across many of the nightmares.
It's going to be on all of your nightmare minions and Lord Chompy Bits.
Yeah. So I guess the next question I'm going to ask is, what's your record at the end of turn 5? How many cards have you removed out of your deck?
Well, if we're getting into Lucid Dream, I think it's sort of a nuanced thing. I don't think it's a mindless thing that you do every single time you can. There's a lot of consideration as to whether the red joker is still in the deck, whether the black joker is still in the deck, and how many high cards you're thinking about removing. Because if you're lucid dreaming later in the game, you have more chances of just pulling up a bunch of highs and mids because you've already thinned the deck out from earlier turns.
And how are you tracking that during the game, Matt? Just kind of getting a feel for it in your head? Are you counting cards? I mean, how much decision-making is going into this, or premonition?
Well, you set the stack up above, you know, the deck of cards as they're being removed. And there is an ability on the Stitch Together's card to bring those cards back into play. So we will talk about when you do pull a high card, or maybe 3 high cards, you can then get those cards back into play. So it's not a total loss on you for taking that risk.
Yeah, cool. A whole new mechanic that we have yet to see.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
So anything else we need to know about Lord Chompy?
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, he's got the ranged attack action. I guess one more thing is that he is the only ski marker removal option. He has Trail of Gore randomly on his card. So again, when he's not lucid dreaming early game, late game, he can be removing enemy ski markers and, you know, causing problems in the denial front.
Yep, that makes sense. So we get him for free. So who's your first hire?
First hire is going to be Serena Bowman.
Okay.
Serena Bowman is a 8 stone enforcer who brings a kit that involves healing. So she brings a bottle of painkillers as a bonus action that is a 1-2-3 heal that ends a condition on the target. It also has a trigger on a mask again to take the action again. Okay. So this is, again, another source of healing for the crew, for Lord Chompy Bits and for Dreamer, notably, or herself, because she tends to soak a lot of aggression, and the condition removal. I mean, I think conditions are going to be a problem for all crews in this game, but yep. Notably, Dreamer's crew has a real problem with them because there's very little condition removal. And the amount of conditions you can give, you know, the widespread ability for models to just be like, everyone's burning or everyone's poisoned. I mean, it happens all the time. So only having the one source of condition removal kind of leaves you lacking and choosing who's not going to have the condition.
Yeah, and conditions are a lot more devastating than they were in second edition. They have a much bigger impact on the game. So they may have consolidated the conditions down a little bit, but there's not conditions that, you know, someone says, well, what's your trigger do? And he says, well, it gives you this. And you go, okay, whatever. Every condition really, really can, you know, punch you in the gut.
Absolutely. They can totally be problems. So that little bit of condition removal she brings is key. It is 3-inch range. So she tends to hang out around Dreamer. She also brings disguised, so she cannot be targeted by charge actions. So she makes a nice speed bump for him.
When she's not healing, is there anything else you're getting out of her?
Absolutely. She's disguised. And again, she has Demise Eternal. Like in 2E when she was released, she'd just pop up on the deployment zone, yep. Which everyone thought was crazy. But again, it follows her fluff. So we're trying to keep things fluffy in third edition, but have abilities that cross across different models. So Demise Eternal, she's, you know, one of the many models in the game that have it. So we all know what it does, and how powerful it can be. But again, it requires a card. Yep. So, you know, anytime you can get someone to use that card to demise, it really puts pressure on the crew overall.
Well, and let's put that in the context of Lucid Dreams. Okay. So I got to tell you, the first time I heard about Lucid Dreams, I was just like, what is going on right now? Like, this is this is broken. It's bonkers. And you're starting to hear chatter right on the forums and in the AWP about, you know, like what kind of BS is this Lucid Dream stuff. But what I think you're doing a good job of, Matt, is kind of pulling back the curtain and saying, look, guys, there is a ton of pressure here. And yes, Lucid Dreams helps. But what you guys don't get is, you know, I'm honing my deck. I've got incredible amount of pressure for, because your summons aren't cheap, and you know the suits aren't free, and Lucid Dreams has helped mitigating some of that pressure. But from the opponent's side, it just looks like you're a powerhouse.
Yeah, well, I think opponents' eyes roll back in their head when you start doing it multiple times, when I think they need to be really looking at what cards you're discarding.
Yeah,
because there have been turns where I've dumped a bunch of high cards. My red Joker's been discarded and my black Joker hadn't been seen. So basically, you're looking at my thin little deck that's got a black Joker in it, and I don't got a bunch of high cards. I'm probably sitting on two in hand. So that should tell you, come and get it, you know. So I think paying a little bit more attention to what's being discarded will help opponents realize the pressure that it does put the Dreamer player under.
That's a great point, Matt, because the only thing that the opponent's really paying attention to is the fact that you pulled an ace out of the deck. what they're really not paying attention to is that you're in turn three, which is a critical turn, and you flipped a 13, an 11, and that three. And you discarded the three, which pisses them off, but that 13 and 11 just went to your discard.
Absolutely. And it's not always that. Sometimes it's a 12, 13 and a one. Right. And you can pull the 13 to use with the stitch together, again, which is the only model in the crew that can do that and pull a card out from the discard or lost card pile. So again, another decision for your opponent to make to, you know, take those models off the field so that you're basically lost those cards that have been removed from the game.
So going back to Serena, is her heal's a bonus, right?
Yes, her heal's a bonus. So she's got a couple other actions that we can definitely go over here. She's got a tendrils attack action, 2-4-6, 2-inch range with a trigger that does blasts.
Yeah.
Now you couple that with an ability on the front of her card called Horrific Reality. And that says when this model declares a claw action, it may reduce its stat by one to measure line of sight and range of the action from any friendly nightmare within 8 inches.
which helps keep her safe.
She's reaching through nightmares at 8 inches away and hitting you for 2, 4, 6.
Yeah, I can see why she's an auto hire. That's pretty good for 8 stones. How many wounds does she have?
She comes with 8 wounds.
Yeah, but you can, but you don't need her up in danger because of that ability to node through nightmares. And what's the stat on again? I'm sorry. What's the stat again on the attack?
Absolutely. Her tendrils attack is a stat 6 when she swings, but it gets that -1 when she uses it through other nightmares. So it'll be coming in at stat 5.
Yeah. So you'd prefer not to do it. So that, okay. That's some nice little balance. I'm with that.
Yeah. But she also has twist reality on her card as well. And we've seen that on Dreamer and Lord Chompy Bits. So again, another option to use this shoot attack that attacks defense, willpower, 2, 3, 4, ignoring armor and incorporeal. I mean, it's just a really great action that kind of gives Dreamer his versatility and utility against any crew in any pool.
And she's sticking close to Dreamer, obviously, because at 7 wounds, you're gonna want her there. So, all right. So I've got Dreamer. I've got Lord Chompy Bits. I've got 2 upgrades. I've got Serena. What's next?
Lastly, for my main hires that I do pretty much every time, I bring in 3 Daydreams.
Oh, wow.
One of which I might cut as we get to the building the crew out to those 50 stones. If I'm, less than 5 stones, I might cut one of those Daydreams and go down to 2 just to keep at least 5 stones in my cash. But I think the Daydreams are really essential to how this crew operates and the control that you can get from it. So what they bring notably is they bring a tactical action called Lead Nightmare. It's a 10-inch range, needs a 5 to go off of any suit. You cannot target a nightmare more than once per activation with this action, and it just simply says move the target up to 3 inches.
Okay.
So you're basically getting to just move your models up into position, out of combat, wherever they need to move, to take full advantage of their activation.
So that'll disengage them if it need be. And how much are these guys?
These guys are 3 stones apiece.
Oh, that's good for 3 stones. That kind of utility is good. What else can they do for you?
Absolutely. They Lucid Dream as well. So you're bringing in more options early game with the 3 Daydreams to get rid of more cards. So you kind of want as many of those early game as you can. So cheap options to Lucid Dream is always good. Yep. They also have a range 8 stat 4 attack. That's like Twist Reality. It can target defense or willpower. It's a 1, 2, 4 damage, ignoring armor and incorporeal. This one doesn't have a gun icon next to it though. So they can just sit around and just blast you with little incidental damage at a stat 4, which honestly adds up if there's 2 or 3 of them, just unloading on you, not having anything else to do late game.
Yeah, but the way that Dreamer's built is you may or may not have the cards to force that 4 through. So I think that helps mitigate it, right?
No, it's at a stat 4. So you'd just be attacking at the lower stat value. But again, you'd have those higher cards left over in your deck late game to possibly get those off.
Right. I guess what I'm saying, though, is that we keep talking about the card pressure that he's under between the summons and, pushing through those willpower duels. And with a low stat 4, even though the attack is good, you may or may not have the cards to cheat in to try to push a stat 4 attack through on, say, a defense or willpower 6 model.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At that point, you're just trying to hope to top deck it and put pressure on your opponent to cheat and maybe use one of their cards. They also have Accomplice, which is really nice for some of those opportunities where you're going to push a model out of combat and you need a little bit of tempo. So you just chuck one of those very, very important cards and Accomplice, and get that model out there doing what you need it to do before your opponent can react to a push.
Yeah, I can see where 3 of them for 9 stones is a good value.
Absolutely. And they're also insignificant. So they're not a liability into Turf War or Reckoning or anything that, your opponent's going to score off of.
Very cool. All right. Any other ones that are making, half or more of your lists?
At that point, I pretty much stop with my main core crew. That's a 21 stones. That gives me, maybe 3 or 4 other models that I can bring in. And those are all going to really vary on who my opponent is and what the scheme pool is.
Yeah, we're going to dive into that, Matt. But I got to tell you, man, that's I like that a little bit because I've got some masters that I've been working. I'm finding myself only having like 15 flex stones and it's a little frustrating. So I kind of like the fact that you really are left with 20 or more stones to flex into the pool and the opponent. That speaks well of Dreamer, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, Dreamer, I think, is the real versatile master in Neverborn. I mean, he can really be brought into most pools because he has a huge hiring pool. I mean, he has like four enforcers, three henchmen, and four minions that all do different things and can help in different ways. Notably, some of the nightmares don't drop any markers. They don't drop corpses.
Nice.
And they don't drop scrap. So in a lot of games, denying any sort of markers being left behind from your presence is a really big deal.
Yeah, where other that games, can be critical. Yeah.
Where other games, you're looking for the armor. You know, you need that armor and you don't necessarily mind the scrap being there on the field. So, you know, it gives you that option to really hire based on who you're going up against.
Well, before we kind of get into, you know, how you spend those flex stones, just out of curiosity, are you finding yourself hiring any other masters into a Dreamer crew occasionally or vice versa, where you find yourself not bringing Dreamer as the leader, but bringing him in as a hire?
You know, the only real one I've tried out has been Zoraida, and that's just because it's sort of a no-brainer in terms of her ability to get you more cards and yeah, efficiently and quickly. Dreamer's too resource-intensive to be brought alongside another master, which I think is a good argument for the double master, you know, thing and conversation that people are having, is that, you know, these masters are card-intensive. And you only get six cards. So if one of those two masters isn't bringing an ability to get cards, you're kind of going to be out of stuff and really relying on luck in the top of the deck.
It's a hidden cost that I don't think has been part of the discussion. That's a great point, Matt.
So, you know, with that, I do think that you could bring Zoraida in a key situation, but you don't need to. I think Dreamer really does well with his own nightmare models and some other versatile models coming in to support him where you see some glaring holes.
Does he have a leader only ability?
Well, his leader only ability, like most summoners, I believe, is to be able to have five of their summon models on the field as opposed to two. Okay. I've seen that across the board for most. So, you know, I've heard cute stories of, you know, bringing Dreamer into a Lucius crew or a Zoraida crew and summoning two Insidious Madness. And you kind of net a few more points than what Dreamer would have cost or hiring the Insidious Madnesses with the tax. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can see that. But again, it's costing you points and you got to kind of have the outward tactical ability to press willpower checks. You know, he can't be brought into Nekama or, you know, certain crews that just are swinging at you at your defense. So,
and what is the cost on Chompy Bits' card?
Yeah, good question. Dreamer is 12 and Chompy Bits' card is 8. So they kind of add up to be what, you know, most master totem combinations, you know, end up being. And in terms of wound count, you know, you got 7 on Dreamer and 8 on Lord Chompy Bits. So, you know, they're comparable to their costs, in my opinion.
Yeah, but you could bring him in, right? Hire him relatively cheap compared to other masters. But to get full value, you know, you'd want Lord Chompy. And then that puts him back up into the, you know, the Lady J McMorning hiring costs. So that's interesting. And the only other thing I'll mention is, I can see what you're saying about bringing Zoraida in because she's Zoraida and she's really good, but she's also attacking willpower, which I would imagine could help him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, her 12 inch willpower attack is just fantastic. And she also has a little bit of tech with the Voodoo Doll popping in and having Widow Weaver just, you know, bring in Stitch Togethers or Wicked Dolls or whatever off of that free scrap. So there is some extra synergy more than just the cards and the ranged willpower. You know, she's a good hire, but again, you weigh that 16 stones against, you know, some other options that are going to get out and, you know, attack the flanks, because once you get Zoraida in there, your bubble in the center is just a huge bubble. You know, and people can run away from it or just scheme around the outside and, you know, leave you standing there.
Yep. No, that's very, very true. All right. So we've been kind of putting it off. So what we'll do, man, when we get back from this break, I want to talk a little bit about how we really do spend those flex stones, because that sounds to be like a big part of a nightmare crew. So we'll be right back. Howdy folks, Craig here. Now, if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. Okay, so now it's really time to get into the meat, Matt. So, we've got four strategies, plant explosives, turf war, corrupted idols, and reckoning. Which of these strategies just makes you go, oh, I'm definitely going to play Dreamer?
Well, I'll tell you, I can take him into most strategies. The one that does give me question is reckoning. Obviously, with a summoner, you're bringing more models into play that your opponent can kill. So that particular strategy can be tough bringing Dreamer into. But I think the other three, in terms of plant explosives, turf war, and corrupted idols, Dreamer does just fine. And he can get across the board pretty quickly. He can really answer the corrupted idols call in terms of putting models near their models, which can typically be near corrupted idol markers. So The versatility there is nice. And then turf war, again, with all the range, 8-inch range, you can kind of pick and choose where models are being killed. So again, reckoning is the one that I would probably back off of with Dreamer.
Is there a Neverborn Master that you would prefer into reckoning?
Yeah, absolutely. I prefer Titania into Reckoning. I feel like her kit is just designed to be really, really difficult to kill. I've had games versus Yanlo where we haven't had a model die until turn four.
Right. That just makes sense.
Denial is key, I feel like, in Reckoning. I see most people bring really, really tough crews. So, with that, I follow suit.
Yeah, it Reckoning is that first point's easy, isn't it? But engineering those second point is not necessarily very easy, depending on how much you got teched against by the opponent. And boy, getting that third and fourth point Reckoning is hard. It's really, really hard because you're running out of models, and pulling that all off in one turn is not very easy. So let's talk about Dreamer into plant explosives. Can you give me kind of a feel of how you're spending those flex stones into plant?
Yeah, absolutely. I think into plant, you're going to be looking at a couple models, notably Widow Weaver and Bandersnatch. Those models create web markers as a bonus action within 6 inches of themselves. It's a drop, so they can pretty much put it wherever they want. It's a 50 millimeter destructible severe web marker. So it really doesn't seem like much, but the ability on the front of both of their cards, Seize Prey, says at the start of this model's activation, they can place to themselves in base contact with a friendly web marker within 12.
Oh, jeez.
And that they're unaffected by web markers. So, with those two models working in tandem, you can really get a leapfrog going or put yourself in position to get in their backfield and plant those explosives away from where the fighting's happening.
Well, and the second layer there is not only can you use them to drop the bombs, but you could also then use them to go back on defense and start picking up some.
Absolutely. They're really tough to pin down, especially when you get that many web markers on the field. And the Bandersnatch is nuanced in his own right. But Widow Weaver technically is the main scheme runner in that facility.
So not only is she dropping bombs, but you're using her potentially to score your schemes.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. She, I mean, with her ability to place 12 inches away onto web markers, she can be in the opponent's backfield away from the fighting to do things like breakthrough.
Right. Search the ruins, all that.
Power ritual. Absolutely. Yep. Power ritual. So I've definitely used her to utility there because she just, you can't catch up with her unless you have a really fast model.
Now, do you think that they're a dynamic duo? Like, if I'm going to hire one, I'm always going to hire the other? Or do you just bring one into the crew at some time?
No, you can get away with just bringing one into the crew. In a plant explosives game, you're giving yourself a lot more vectors to place those bomb markers because they do have to be 6 inches away from each other. So having the ability to just pop out and place within range, 12 inches is huge. You can walk and then place the bomb and you really have no chance of being within 6 inches of another bomb marker. That's been a problem for me in the past with other crews that don't necessarily have those big movement abilities to really get really far away from where they were at the start of their activation.
That is a hidden challenge in plant explosives that I'm glad you brought up, Matt, because it if someone has a bomb on them, they're a target. And, usually a way the lot of crews work is you protect your targets by keeping them close to the crew. But in order for you to get those bombs 6 inches away from other bombs, they need to kind of go on their own a little bit. So abilities like Seamus's teleport and these web marker things can be critical for plant explosives.
Absolutely. I mean, it's how you win games with these crews because the action economy it takes to chase them into your own backfield to stop it usually allows you to win the fight and win the model fight and then just win the game in the end. So it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. You just let them go and score and hope that me sending 8 stones into your backfield is enough to, turn the tide of battle.
So I'm going to suspect, Matt, that you might even consider them for Turf War.
Absolutely. Turf War is a wonderful strategy for Dreamer to go into. Again, I feel like his ability to reach out and do some range damage as well with the core key of the Dreamer, Lord Chompy Bits, and Serena Bowman gives you those tactical options and choices to kind of reach out and touch somebody in a table quarter to deny them points.
And how are you handling corrupted idols? So how are you handling the damage that gets done? Are you relying on your summons to get those idols over?
Well, corrupted idols is actually probably my favorite strategy with Dreamer. Again, the ability to hit people at 8-inch range with willpower attacks and pop a model in base contact with them means that you don't necessarily need to be right next to these corrupted idol markers to either deny interaction with them or to gain position on them. An Insidious Madness or a Stitch Together are going to pop up in base contact with you as you're going after one of those corrupted idol markers. So it gives me that option to, put pressure wherever I need to on the board and maybe, again, save one of those very, very high cards, those valuable high cards for putting that corrupted idols marker where I want it. But again, I think Dreamer's ability to kind of place models where he wants to with his summon and his the way that mechanic works makes him really, really good in corrupted idols.
Well, and anybody who's listened to this podcast knows that the two themes that we keep hearing is flexibility and mobility. And it sounds like he's got a lot of that, though a little bit different than we're hearing with other masters, which I think is kind of neat. So, Matt, I'm hearing a lot of tears about Stitched. So can we talk about Stitched and why so many people are like hating that model?
Absolutely, we can. Stitched are definitely a tough model. They are 6 soulstones. They are defense 6. They have armor 1, bloated stench, and the most important and hated ability of Fiendish Gamble, which I spoke about a little bit earlier. This is a once per activation. When this model would flip a card, it may instead choose a card its controller has removed from the game and place it into the conflict. That card is no longer considered removed from the game. So
so if Lucid Dreams wasn't pissing you off, this will.
yeah, exactly. And it happens. I mean, and the problem with it is that they can use it defensively with their defense 6 one time during the opponent's activation. And that can stick people when you're like, I'm at a defense slip in 19. What are you going to do? You know? So yeah. I understand the frustration completely. With that, they are the only model in the crew that can do it. They are minion threes that can be summoned, but they can also be killed. You know, they can be killed just like anyone else. It just takes some work.
And what's the wound count on them?
They got 6 wounds, armor 1.
Okay. And armor 1, 6 wounds. So they're killable. Defense 6 is pretty serious though. And then that ability to pull in cards,
that's a problem.
Boy. Yeah. I would suspect they're early targets then, right? Before you have a chance to build that kind of lucid dream sideboard.
Well, I would think that would be my personal approach to the crew. They're also one of the few models that don't have terrifying on the card. So you are free to attack them and to gang up on them with multiple models. And that pressure just, you know, puts them out in my experience.
And they can only do that once per turn or once per activation?
Once per activation.
Okay.
So on the back of their card, they have a tactical action that feels more like an attack action. And I think this is another sticking point for Stitch Together. I mean, if you didn't already hate them, Craig, you're going to hate them right now after I get done telling you about this tactical action. So this goes on a 4 and it's range 6. It says enemy only, this model and the target both flip over the top card of their fate deck, which cannot be cheated. So you can go ahead and use your fiendish gamble on this ability and pull a card that's been removed from the game. And then the loser, or in the case of a tie, the model suffers 3, 4, 5 damage.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And so, that's a tactical action.
Yeah. It's a tactical action.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
All right, so here comes the big question. So there's two questions here then. So what does Dreamer need to summon him? What's the card that he needs?
Dreamer needs a 10 of mass to summon a Stitch Together.
All right. So the next big question is that there's 6 soul stones, right?
Yes.
Would you hire them at 7? Be honest.
I might hire 1 at 7.
Okay. But 2 at 6?
I've been known to hire 2 at 6. Yeah, okay. Definitely. All right.
So, I mean, that means they're close. It's a model, and I'm doing my best, Matt, to try to keep this under control, because it happens to me all the time with 3, where, like, I hear a model, I'm like, what the hell? But, like, after I give it some time and play against them, I kind of realize that they actually are balanced, but they feel unbalanced. I'm at the this feels unbalanced phase of the Stitch Together. It'll be interesting to see 6 months from now if it turns out that there's reasons, or maybe you can make the argument of why they should be 6 stones and should have everything that they have.
Well, you know, in my honest opinion, if I were to do something to this card, have whatever opinion you want, I think movement 4 on this model would bring it back into the fair category. I think what people fail to realize is that they have a threat range of 11 inches if they're able to take a walk action and then gamble their life against you. So the amount of shooting at 12 inch range, or just shooting in general, ranged attack options in the game should put these models under pressure. And again, with that, you're not always pulling 13s out of the deck. You know, I may pop an 11 out and think that's going to be enough, and you flip a 12. You know, it's one of the few models in the game that hurts itself. So, you know, I could see maybe the movement 5 being a problem, or maybe even bringing their defense down 1 click to defense 5. Other than that, I don't think I would mess with their cost.
Yeah, it's a model that has stirred up enough conversations that I think that that conversation won't die on its own. So I'll be very anxious to see again as all of this matures. Let's see where they are. And I think it was, we released a couple of weeks ago the podcast with Brian, who was out of the Georgia Meadow, that we were talking about their Grow League. And he had a great quote, which is, everything feels broken right now. And I'm trying to remind myself of that, when people see me with a McMorning at a poison 11 and he's healing, 4 at the end of the turn, you know, that feels real broken to them. And it's very frustrating to them. So it's real easy to remember how you've been frustrated by other masters. You forget how frustrating you've been to others. And it's kind of the new world we're in.
It's just the way the game's designed. You know, everything's broken. I totally agree with that sentiment. And you got to take licks on the chin and accept that that's the way that it is. Those are the rules, and get back and figure out a way to approach that same situation again and do better the next time. There are answers to everything in this game, in my opinion.
Yeah, and the keyword system makes it a little bit simpler to kind of keep track of, right? So you don't have to learn the 130 models that are in Malifaux. You only need to learn, you know, the couple dozen keywords and get a sense of them. There is a podcast out there that's covering all of these keywords in detail. So if you see a podcast that's diving into Dreamer and you don't play him, you still may want to listen to it so that you're ready for Dreamer when you see him, because I think the familiarity is a big deal. I recently just played against Dashiell for the first time, and I was like, oh, that seems good. Oh, that seems good. Oh, we can do that too. That seems nice. but I'll play it differently the next time I face him, right? Now that I know and have seen him on the table, I've got a better sense of how he works. And you know, 2 hours after the game, I could already start to piece together the chinks in his armor. We've got to let this stuff mature a little bit. So, man, I think that gives us a real good sense of, you know, a feel for the different strategies. Is there any other key tech pieces that we should talk about? Some key hires that come up based off of the strategies that we didn't already talk about?
Absolutely. You know, it's tough because there are so many different models in a Dreamer crew. You know, you could go over each of them individually, and I believe they're all great and they all have their uses. So, you know, we haven't spoken about Coppelius yet, who I find to be very, very valuable at 9 stones in kind of being a solo scheme runner or even kind of an alt beater. You know, he can get in there and deal some damage again to kind of the fainting or the deception that you can bring into the game. I feel like models like Coppelius really give you that option to deceive your opponent, to say, hey, I'm doing this one thing, and then come back and do another.
Is that because he can switch gears so easily?
Absolutely. At 9 stones, he should be able to. I mean, he's a 9-stone enforcer, so you're really investing in this guy to be able to do that for you. He's movement 7, which is kind of his notable stat on his card. He has your, you know, obligatory terrifying feed on fear, and he's bringing regeneration 1. So he's got a little staying power. Lastly, he's got agile on his card. So this model may leave the engagement range of enemy models with the walk action. You know,
agile is so good with the strategies and schemes we have right now.
I mean, as another bomb guy who can go in the middle and punch somebody in the face and then walk away from it and plant the bomb later. I mean, he's just excellent. And you have to talk about Coppelius. He's not an always hire, but he's definitely someone you can bring out if someone maybe is getting used to Widow Weaver or getting used to maybe a Teddy approach. You can drop Coppelius on them and be like, well, you know, what's this? And again, it kind of adds to Dreamer's versatility as a keyword. The nightmare keyword is there's just so many different options to bring. Your opponent's going to be on their heels every time they play him.
So speaking of Teddy, one of the most iconic things in Malifaux, what has to be in place for you to consider Teddy as a hire?
Teddy, he's definitely a scheme pool and opponent master dependent hire. You know, if I see Mei Fang coming, Teddy's coming. He's being brought to the party because of her ability to do the vent steam and make every non-enemy non-construct deal with hazardous. I feel like Teddy's a good answer to that, which is something that I do see commonly, you know, considering the group of players I play with. But he definitely comes into the killier schemes. If I need someone to fake a claim jump, or if I have a assassinate, you know, in the pool and I'm really kind of going for that, even a take prisoner, Teddy's really good at executing pretty much by himself.
Interesting.
Teddy has a bold over trigger, Push target 4 inches away from this model, then push this model 4 inches towards the target. You know, it's amazing how many times I've taken prisoner with Teddy, just picking someone up, walking away with them and being like, I got you. You know, it's kind of that hidden tech that people don't necessarily think about with that, those sorts of schemes.
And, you know, I'm a broken record, Matt, but Malfo is so complicated in a good way. Like, again, you read a bold over trigger, right? And you say, well, what the hell? Like, okay, great. I get to move him 4 and I get to move 4. But when you start thinking about it in the context of the pools, you start to realize how big it can be, you know, not only for a take prisoner, but for a plant explosives. For there's so, like, positioning is so important for scoring, and your ability to say your model is going to go here is a big deal. I mean, it's why everybody, you know, is crying about Zareda, is because just positioning is so important. And it's, again, another ability that reads fine and plays great.
Absolutely. And Teddy's really been given a boost. I mean, he's no longer defense 3 anymore, people. So
that's nice.
You can just hire him every game and he'll do some work for you. I mean, he's your quintessential beater. He's got flurry on his card. He's got armor 1 regen. So, you know, the guy can definitely knock some teeth in on the opponent's side. I've got your back as well as a tactical action, which is, again, good defensive tech for Dreamer or Serena if they're in trouble. 6-inch range, goes off on a 5. Target other friendly engaged model. Target is placed in base contact with this model. You know, you just basically pop someone out of danger and put them behind your Teddy and say, you know, you got to come through me.
Is there do we still have any kind of synergies between him and Baby Cade?
Absolutely. That's going to be on Baby Cade's card. He's got a bonus action that moves and heals him and Teddy. And on Baby Cade's card, it says that you can hire Teddy into a woe crew at no additional cost.
Got it. Now, do you ever find yourself playing the tax to bring in Cade, or is it just not worth it?
You know, Cade is an interesting choice. He's one of the few models that has a lure at a stat 7. And we all know how good a 12-inch willpower duel at stat 7 is going to be in a Dreamer crew, you know, when you can pop a Nightmare into base contact with them after they've walked towards you. He also has a trigger on a Crow to give a model slow. So, I mean, that's just an absolute double whammy with Baby Cade. Does he get into a lot of my crews? Not at all. For 8 stones, he can definitely be a liability, but it's definitely not out of the question.
Got it. So expanding our scope a little bit, I want to learn more about, because we have a lot of stones to play with after your core. Can we talk about some other tech pieces that you bring in based off of not only the strategies, but is there some other tech pieces we haven't talked about that maybe are scheme dependent?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm definitely one to bring Doppelganger in as a versatile model, depending on the scheme pool. I mean, her ability of Don't Mind Me is just fantastic. I mean, everyone knows the ability to drop a scheme marker in base contact when you're about to dig someone's grave, or to get that last scheme marker you need for whatever while you're engaged is just huge. You know, Doppelganger also can mimic other models as a bonus action. And the thing about this mimic now in this edition is it says the stat for the action is considered to be equal to the stat for this action. And her stat for a mimic is a 7. So if you copy Lord Chompy Bit's heavy claws, you're swinging at a stat 7, 3, 4, 6 damage.
Thank God it's a bonus.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bonus and she can charge.
Right, and but I mean, like, thank God she can only do it once.
Well, no, she gets that action for the entire for her activation. So,
oh, no kidding. So the bonus grants her the action, then she can use it for the other 2 actions.
Yes.
Oh, dude,
one of the target's non-bonus actions that does not attach upgrades or list a model by name.
That sounds really good. That
non-master
sounds good.
Only. So non-master. So yeah. You know, he's not a master. He's just a henchman. And it says until in phase, you treat the selected action and its triggers as though it were printed on this card.
I am surprised that we have not heard more crying about that model. That's very interesting. I just assumed when you were telling me that it was just his bonus, or her bonus, I should say. So, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, she gets to do it once, but if that kind of activates her to allow her to do it for the other two, wow, that's cool. Yeah. And, you know what? And just real quick, here's another thing that I've got to fanboy over three about is, That's not what she did in two, but that's how she felt in two, which I think is really cool. So it seems to me like doppelganger is still doppelganger, even though mechanically she's a little different. So that's neat.
Absolutely. And notably, she also has the 12-inch lure as an attack action, targeting willpower on a six with great triggers. So again, another option to reach out and get those nightmares on the field.
And her existing hurts your need for Cade.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't consider Cade because I have doppelganger, really.
Yep,
I mean,
yep.
When we're being real about it.
Very, very cool. Is there any other key ones we need to know about?
Yeah, oddly enough, this is a model I'd like to talk about because I've always been a fan of his story. And I think he's fantastic in this edition and fantastic with Dreamer. And that's Tuco Ortega.
No kidding. Very cool. I'm dying to hear this.
I mean, Tuco Ortega, who'd have thunk it? Well, this guy, he deploys from the shadows and he has stealth. So right there, I have a node up front on the field of play that's going to make you have to react to that. So I'm asking you to come to me. And this guy has a willpower attack as a bonus action that is 6-inch range at a stat 6. It's called Disillusion, and it says move the target up to its move in inches with a trigger to give distracted one. So, you know, this guy can walk twice, 10-inch range with a 6-inch reach. I mean, that's 16-inch threat range, deploying from the shadows to pop a nightmare up in your opponent's crew before they even get started on turn one.
Yeah, I was about to say that could happen turn one if it with the activation order in the right order.
Yeah, that is definitely the hope. Another model that does that is the Bandersnatch. Movement 6 on the Bandersnatch, and then again, a willpower attack as a bonus at 6-inch range with a stat 6. So you got a couple of different really fast models that can get up the board and really try to disrupt as early as possible to start soaking some actions from your opponents.
I'm glad to see that Ortega is going to get some play in this edition because I've always liked the sculpt, and you hinted at it. Just the fluff of him is great. So that makes me happy that he'll get play.
Yeah, and his custom shotgun is actually pretty decent too. I mean, it's something you don't see a lot in Neverborn, having some ranged guns with some blasts, but you know, it's got three triggers, which are all good. And you know, I've gotten some good use out of his shotgun on the field as well. So you know, Tuco is not someone to look over.
That's good. Matt, can you give me an idea of maybe three or four schemes that you just love taking Dreamer into?
Yeah, absolutely. I am a big fan of, like I said before, Take Prisoner with Dreamer. I think his crew has so many options to move enemy models around that he can really do this scheme as easy as can be. And most notably, Serena Bowman on her Twist Reality attack has a trigger on a tome, which isn't used by really anyone else in the crew. It says enemy only, place the target in, within 6 inches of its current location. It's a hole in the world trigger. So, you know, with that, you're able to reach out to somebody and basically take them prisoner, you know, with one action by pulling them deep into your crew.
Yep.
Another one that I like is Assassinate. I absolutely love going after opponent's masters and putting pressure on my opponent. I feel like that is the main tenet of a Dreamer crew, is to constantly apply pressure to your opponent to make them make bad decisions, get frustrated, and kill things they don't need to kill.
Yep.
So notably, I think those are my two. You know, I'll live with Hold Up Their Forces, Vendetta, pretty much anything that doesn't involve scheme markers, to be honest.
That makes sense, because you may not have the, like you talked about at the very beginning, you may not have the action efficiency to really take advantage of having to lay three markers somewhere on a given turn to score. Is there any schemes that Dreamer does a good job of countering?
You know, I think Dreamer is out there definitely to score as many points as he can.
Yep.
His denial game is merely Lord Chompybits being able to pick a scheme marker up with Trail of Gore. Or actually physically walking up to their scheme markers and picking them up. So where we don't have a lot of denial. We're going out to score and to eliminate enemy models to gain the advantage, honestly. So, you know, anything's a go against Dreamer.
Yeah, and deleting models is a way of denial, let's be honest.
Yeah, and that's really the tenet of Dreamer's crew. I mean, they're all murderers. They all have great attack actions that deal a lot of damage. They don't have scheme abilities. They don't have abilities to get more actions. They just kill. So, you know, you need to approach the game that way and try to remove your enemy's models or disrupt them enough to soak all of their actions into a, you know, incidental summon model that's, you know, bogging them down.
Yep. Well, boy, I think having that flexibility is nice, Matt. There's, even though I think there's several models that you've talked about that all do different things, there's still that thematic tie in the keyword, which makes me happy. It reminds me a little of Yanlo in that way, where Yanlo has a pretty diverse pool to pick from, but they still feel like they should be together, but there's definite tech pieces involved. What we're going to do, Matt, is we're going to take one more break. And when we get back from this break, I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about, you know, what do you learn after you've played Dreamer 10 times? So let's talk a little bit about second level play. And then we need to figure out how to handle this guy. So we'll be right back.
Awesome.
So, Matt, I've been, you know, trying to really focus on two masters as I've, you know, been cut my teeth on three. And I'm glad I am not focusing on five masters, because I'm noticing as I get more and more reps in on these two masters that new layers of the onion are getting peeled apart, and I'm finding new things that are very situational that could end up winning me a game later on. So I would like to get a sense from you. You know, first time I put Dreamer on the table, I've read his cards, he's going to play a certain way, I kind of get what he said. But I would imagine that, you know, after 10 or 15 reps of Dreamer, there's been things that you've kind of noticed about him that may not be obvious from the go. So I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah. And absolutely. That's just getting into how to use him as a disruption master to get your opponent making poor decisions. You know, you have to build your crew around willpower duels that you know that you can get off. And it takes time to get to that point with Dreamer, because there's just so much going on. There's so many different models in his crew that you really have to focus on a few of them, learn what they do, and learn how they help support each other to make the crew wholly effective. You know, it's one thing to hear about a crew secondhand and how powerful it can be in the hands of a good player, but I think the time and effort it takes to get to that point is with Dreamer. It took time. You know, I think he is definitely one of those learning curve masters that, you know, you're not going to start hit the ground running like Nekoma, where you can charge in and, you know, smack something in the face at stat 7 with a sword. You have to learn how to utilize your resources available and put them in the right place. Otherwise, you'll fold like a lawn chair against certain crews.
And remind me, Matt, there was what were the three cards that he summoned with? Was it a 9, 10, and 11? Or is it 10, 11, 12? I can't remember.
Well, the notable summons are 9, 10, and 11. That would be your Alp, which is a significant model, a Sitch Together, and an Insidious Madness. The Daydream would be summoned on a 7.
Got it. And having played summoners, especially like Nico, you know, the first time you get to play these guys, you're like, oh, if my card's high enough, I know exactly what model I'm going to summon in, the highest one I can for the card that I have. I would imagine that there's some second level play of saying that, you know, I might have the 12, which means I could summon any of them, but I know that this lower cost model is going to be the tool I need for the job.
Yeah, because you need to allocate that 12 to something else. It can't be over costed or overused. You know, if you only needed a 10 and you're using a 12, yeah, that's really tough to swallow for a Dreamer player.
Yeah, and there's a lot of resource management that I'm hearing here too, whether it be resource management from Go and deciding how many stones to have, really knowing where to do it. Disruption crews are so frustrating to play against. But again, when you're on the other side of the table playing a disruption crew, there's a lot of tough decisions deciding where you're going to focus that disruption. Because it's no good if I lock down the center of the board I get taken from my flanks, or I lock down the left hand of the board and get taken from my flanks. It sounds to me like he's a master that you just got to get your reps in.
Absolutely. Yep. He is going to take time to understand how he works. And another thing that I've learned over the many games I've played with him is, again, kind of the nuanced opinion about Lucid Dream. The first few times you use it, you're going to be kind of blown away, like, wow, I'm pulling all these cards out of the deck. But the more you use it, the more you see that red Joker discarded, the more you start noticing those 13s and 12s and 11s you constantly discard, and how often your hand sucks. And your opponent doesn't know that. So it's really important for you as a player to physically kind of keep your attitude up, like you have the cards when you really don't. How many times my opponents could just come in on me when I'm sitting on a bunch of fours is incredible. But they don't know that. They're worried about the fact I'm removing cards and summoning models and doing all this stuff. They forget that, you know, there's a hand of cards involved too, you know.
Well, and anybody who's ever done a triple negative damage flip and flipped a 12, an 11, and a 2 knows, you know, just how common it is to be in the situation when you've done that Lucid Dream and you've had to discard those two severes.
Yeah, definitely. It's not always the perfect situation with Lucid Dream. So, you know, it is what it is, but there are ways to combat that.
And to be clear, there's nothing that we've said, Matt, in the last hour and a half that in any way has lowered the rage people have about Lucid Dreams.
No, okay.
We do deserve a small trophy for trying, right?
Absolutely. Hey, I play the dude. I have to defend it. So
That's right. All right. So let's talk about things that that Dreamer's afraid of. Let's talk about how to counter what really sounds like a powerful crew. Now, I've got a little bit of a surprise for you, Matt. There is somebody also in your meta that snuck in a question at the last minute, and it's somebody you actually have played a good bit. It's another guy named Matt, and Matt is asking a question which when I heard the question, I suspected maybe he's played you before. So let's hear what Matt wants to ask Matt.
Hello, this is Matt from Portland, Oregon. My question is, given how often I see Serena Bowman hired into a Dreamer crew, is there a way that I can minimize her effectiveness, or is that a game that you want me to play? Am I just wasting my time?
So, Matt, how does Matt handle the fact that your first hire is Serena Bowman? What is the best way to deal with her?
I think the best way to deal with Serena Bowman is to deal with Serena Bowman. There is the caveat that she cannot be targeted by claw attack actions from a charge action. I mean, she has disguised, which is discouraging as can be, but you know, we also have options to move our models up the field, give them focus and utilize single attack actions to do damage. If there's any model in the crew that you want to take down early, it's Serena Bowman. I definitely would advise any player playing against Dreamer to put in the effort, hire a model that you know is capable of getting in there and putting the pressure on, maybe even two models. It's not futile. Her demise ability does require a card. And once you've done it once, you know, you're down to those four wounds. And, I've seen her go down many times through a concerted effort, which in the long run hurts my crew overall. So it's just one of those things. It slows down the tempo of my crew to remove her, and notably Daydreams as well, I would say.
I think that's good. And it, with every model that, is a craw on somebody's rear end, you have to make that decision, and this is really what I think Matt was hinting at here in his question was, you know, am I better off ignoring her or, going through the pain in the ass process of taking care of her And if I read what you just said correctly, Matt, you're saying it's worth the effort to try to get her off the board.
It absolutely is. Leaving her on the board just adds tempo and longevity to my crew, no matter what. So if it takes a few models, two or three models, to just jump on her and get her off the board, it'll be in your best interest. There's a lot of models in the game that are like this, that require multiple models coming in and just wasting activations to kill. But when she's gone, those models are free to do whatever they want, and I'm down a model.
Yeah, and it hurts you. It hurts you. What are other things that scares you when the opponent reveals their crew, or when they're start to start doing things on turn three? What are you scared of
on turn three?
Well, in general. So what do you like to, what do you prefer not to see happening?
Well, I prefer to see the opponent not being aggressive and coming into my kitchen and disrupting the pedestal that I want Dreamer standing on. You know, mm-hmm. You play Molly, so you know how it is to put that support master in a position midway up the field and stay there and just control the battlefield from that position. It's in the best interest of the opponent to move that position to where they don't want to be. You don't have to kill Dreamer or kill Molly, you know, or Lucius or whichever support master is back there just having a heyday with you. You just need to displace them, move them, make them spend cards to, you know, defend themselves or stones to mitigate damage. That is my number one key advice, is to be aggressive. You know, he's coming at you aggressively. You have to come at him aggressively.
It's something that you and I have talked about a few times now, which is that pressure. And we all know what it feels like to have the pressure put on us, but you don't realize what an impact, because when you put pressure on your opponent, a lot of stuff that is resulting from that pressure is hidden from you, which are things that they didn't do. Choices they didn't make, cards they didn't play, and the tough decisions you force them into. And when you're under pressure, you see all of it. When you're putting on the pressure, you don't see as much of it. So, not a huge fan of the fact that you revealed that about Molly, but that's okay, Matt. But you're 100% right. I want Molly in the center of the board. I want her to see as much as possible. I want you to go, God, that, you know, Serene Continence is such a pain in my behind to kiss, and there's some healing, and, you know, I'm just not going to bother with her. I'm a huge fan of you having that perspective.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, if these models are one walk away from being wholly effective, they're a problem, you know, and being in that center position, you're basically one walk away, two actions away from seriously affecting the game state. And if you're pushing these models off of that point, their actions are wasted maneuvering or whatever else.
Yeah. If we're spending time with making Dreamer walk, if we're spending time making Dreamer stone, to prevent damage because he's, you know, he's down to three wounds, forcing him to spend a 12 or a 13 to defend himself. Those are critical resources.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, ways to combat him, in my opinion, would be at the hiring phase. I think that's where you have to start going at a Dreamer crew. If someone's declaring Dreamer, it's just like hearing Sheamus or any terrifying crew. You need to look at your ruthless options. I know most factions have them, and they exist. So with that, you just hire one or two ruthless options and use them effectively. I mean, you'll see how I start to maneuver away from those models with certain models. That's affecting me. That's affecting my ability to do what I want to do and score the points I want to score. So I think looking into that and finding out what your faction has to offer in terms of ruthless is key. Secondly, I always, tell people, look into range options as well. Snipers are a problem for me. Anything that shoots 12 to 14 inches is a problem. I'm kind of a bubble crew. You know, Dreamer sits there with his Serena and his Daydreams, and they, kind of orchestrate the fight from that position. And if you're able to pop a Daydream a turn, you know, shoot at Dreamer to make him discard a card to then pop a Daydream a turn, you know, that's all pressure. And that all drives a Dreamer player crazy. You know, they're going to be moving away from that sniper, from that shooting element, as opposed to, you know, doing what they want to do.
Well, and it gets to what you've already talked about, Matt, which is messing with your kitchen, right? You're going to go in with Dreamer, and there's a definite thing you want to see happen. And it sounds to me like anything the opponent can do to twist that reality is going to hinder your ability to win the game.
Absolutely.
Very cool, my friend. So this was our first Neverborn deep dive. And I'm really glad it was on Dreamer. Matt, I enjoyed it, man. It's obvious that you've played him a good bit. I have a sneaking suspicion there's a lot of Neverborn players that have been starving, and you just gave them a nice dinner. So two things. One, we got to talk you into coming back so that we can talk about some more Neverborn, so we can get a little bit more of a broader coverage here on the Third Floor podcast. And two, I really want to talk at some point on a future episode about that Pacific Northwest meta. You've reached out to me. I've had a couple other people up there reach out to me. We've got the USFO tour coming up. I think that you guys have a very exciting meta happening up there that isn't even totally fully formed, but it seems it has a lot of momentum. So I'm going to have to maybe get you guys on the show to talk about some of the exciting stuff you got going on up there.
Absolutely. The game's been out less than a month at this point, and there's a huge buzz. I mean, everyone's coming back from second edition. We have pretty much the whole I-5 corridor from Portland up to Bellevue buzzing about this game and getting That's tournaments great. Organized and getting people back in and playing on regular game nights. So it is sort of a budding meta that I hope to, you know, be a powerhouse in the future.
good. So Matt, is there anything that the listeners should know about, some plugs that you want to get out there?
Yeah. I'd simply just like to plug our PDX meta here. I run a game night Tuesday nights down there at the Portland Game Store off of Killingsworth in Portland, Oregon on Tuesday nights. We start typically around 5 p.m. and go till close. You know, I know there are a lot of Malifaux players in the area that we have not met yet. I mean, we see the product go off the shelves and we're wondering, you know, where are these people? So I know there are people in our community that maybe listen to your podcast that I don't even know yet. So, you know, I'd like to put the word out that that's where we meet. We do have tournaments there occasionally, and the nearest tournament is actually coming up this Saturday at the Mox Boarding House up in Bellevue. So I'm not sure if the podcast will be out in time to plug it, but you know, it's coming up this Saturday, and that's kind of the big thing we're going to go do.
Yeah, that probably will be in the past by the time we release this. But have you ever been up to that store?
Oh yeah, I've been there many a times.
So I've heard it's pretty cool up there. That's kind of a neat shop.
Yeah, the Mox Boarding House is really an unbelievable shop. It's really high end. I'd call it like a 5-star restaurant in terms of game stores. It has a restaurant, a bar, a whiskey room, all of which you can openly play board games, RPGs, whatever you want to do in a setting that feels like you're at a restaurant.
That's cool.
Yeah, their tournament room is huge. It has screens and really great tracking and support for anyone that wants to run tournaments there in terms of, you know, digital tech to organize and to, you know, make it feel like you're at something really special, which is important, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that sounds like the kind of place where even the Magic players take showers.
Well, we're in the Northwest, my friend, so yeah.
So you just might smell a bunch of patchouli and that's it.
You're damn right. Yep. Maybe a little something right. else too, but hey.
That's true. That's funny, man. All right, man. We're going to definitely have to talk again soon. And I do appreciate you spending the time. And for everybody listening, thanks for listening. Take care.
Thanks for having me on, Craig. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and write a review on this podcast so we can find more people almost as cool as you are. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube by searching for Third Floor Wars. That's THIRD. We'll catch you next time on the Third Floor.